Hello, this is the final episode of Season 3. Thank you so much for joining me this far on the journey. I can't say for sure when Season 4 will come out, and there will likely be a longer gap in between this season and the next season than there was between this season and the last. I thank you so much for your patience, and your excitement, and all of those amazing reviews that you've shared. They warm my heart, give me so much confidence, and really are essential for getting new listeners to the show. So thank you so much. If you haven't written a review or rated the show, please consider doing so. And share it on social media. It's a big help. As you know, this show is commercial-free, and I plan to keep it that way. But you can help expedite the process by becoming a patron. Go to sonofelppodcast.com/support. It's only a couple bucks a month, but it makes a huge difference on my end. Especially at building up my confidence. So thanks, I really appreciate it. Now, enjoy the show. See you next season. You're listening to Book 2 of Superman, Son of El. He is more than a story. He is more than a comic book superhero. He is more than a symbol of hope. He represents our greatest aspirations. He is everything we think we can be. And yet, even with all the strength and all the power in all of the world, he may not be able to meet his greatest challenges and redeem his family's legacy, for he is the Son of El. Chapter 19, Tomorrow's Potential. In the wake of the Star Labs disaster in Coast City, Clark found his interest in T.O. Morrow renewed. Dr. Linda Holland had confirmed Morrow's involvement in whatever experiment transformed her associate, Dr. Kitty Faulkner, into a hulking superpowered woman and sent her on a rampage. Unfortunately, Holland refused to comment any further, quitting her job and choosing to disappear. Explaining this all to Lana helped Clark sort it out for himself.
She said something about this happening before, to her husband, but she also said that had nothing to do with Morrow.
Lana leaned her chin into her hands as her elbows rested on the table.
I think we should still look into it, find out what she means. You would think if this had happened before, you of all people would have heard about it. I mean, this is kind of your area of expertise.
Are scientific mishaps supposed to be my field of expertise?
Well, kinda, but just call it a hunch. This feels like it would be right up your alley.
Sure enough, they found an obituary for Dr. Alec Holland, along with several newspaper articles. He and his wife Linda were notable biologists working in Louisiana when Alec died in a tragic accident. His body had disappeared, lost in the adjacent swamp by their lab. All the while, rumors of his disappearance often alluded to some monster having abducted him. Linda initially reported gang involvement, yet later, she recanted her testimony and left the area. Clark scratched his chin as they looked over this discovery.
Okay, well, considering the article mentions a monster, you weren't that far off suggesting I should have heard about it.
I told you. But considering you've been retired for a while now, I can understand how you would have not heard about this.
Clark's next move was to ask Dr. Linda Faulkner. She had survived her transformation, but was living at the bottom of the sea in the hidden city of Atlantis. There, she escaped the solar rays that ignited her powers. And yet Clark could not speak to Faulkner, as she remained in a coma, attended to by the Atlanteans. Returning home from a visit to that city under the sea, Clark found Martha, still awake in the kitchen.
Baking? At this hour?
I couldn't sleep, so I figured I'd get ahead for the bake sale tomorrow. But what's your excuse?
I just came back from checking in on Dr. Faulkner in Atlantis. I hope I didn't hurt her too badly.
Clark, she was on a rampage, and you did your best.
That's what I try to tell myself, but it's hard to say. And it's been a while since I've done this kind of stuff, so I'm a bit rusty.
Martha joined Clark at the table, sitting down as she transferred the cookies from the baking tray to the cooling rack.
Don't you mind those road bumps. That's all a part of refining your process.
That's an awfully kind assessment, Ma, but I feel like I should have done a better job of being Superman.
Take my word on it, Clark. I know it feels that way, but that's just what happens when you return to an old practice after a lifetime of new experiences. You've got higher standards now, and you have to figure out how to live up to them.
Maybe. But I can't let go of the sense that I messed up. I still have no idea what Mara was up to, or if he's even up to anything at all. Maybe this is just a coincidence, and I'm caught up in some goose chase conspiracy theory.
Take your time, Clark. You'll figure this out. And though I can't fix your troubles, I can offer you a cookie. I know you like them hot, so take two.
As usual, Martha's words helped more than she knew, and the cookies didn't hurt either. Having no thought for sleep, Clark decided to take advantage of his unrest by taking a late-night visit to Gotham to see if anyone was up at the Batcave. Martha sent him with a box of cookies. Sure enough, the Batcave was unusually busy when Clark arrived. Bruce had recently returned along with his son, Damian, and Cassandra Cain, the Batwoman. The three of them huddled around the main computer's monitor. A fourth figure sat away from the others, in the shadows. At first, when Clark entered, he thought it was Dick Grayson. But upon closer inspection, after greeting everyone, Clark saw that this mysterious figure was Jason Todd, Bruce's apprentice, returned from the dead. Seeing Jason in person, a pang of grief washed over Clark. The young man held especially still, doing his best to downplay his response to Superman's entrance. Clark gave him a nod, but said no more for the time being, unsure what it meant to see him back at the Batcave after all these years. The others welcomed Clark and began sharing their current investigation. Out of the group, Damian was the least reluctant to speak.
So what we know about him so far is that he worked for some secret order of the Knights Templar, but they're a splinter division. He uses the codename Azrael, and his suit is cool as hell, with flaming fists and a sword made of fire.
Azrael, huh? Knights Templar? Where does this guy land on the spectrum between the Lightkeepers and the League of Shadows?
Damian's brow furrowed, but Bruce answered the question. The Order of Dumas broke free of the Knights Templar ages ago, betraying the Lightkeepers. But since then, they've separated from Ra's al Ghul in the League of Shadows. At this point, they're a fanatical cult, slowly dying off, yet now they've thrown their hat into the arena of superpowered metahumans. Azrael recently arrived on the East Coast and is spending most of his time here in Gotham.
What's that mean? Is he giving you a hard time? What's he doing?
Cassandra leaned back on the console. With languid disinterest, she answered.
Nothing I wouldn't do if I had the opportunity.
Damian wasn't afraid to voice his opinion either.
And it's a good thing you don't. Father's drawn the line, and Azrael has crossed it.
This prompted Jason to finally join the conversation.
That's not it at all. The Batman is where he's not the scariest guy in Gotham anymore.
Damian shot him a glare.
You watch your mouth. Make me Junior.
That's enough out of the two of you. Jason's not entirely wrong. It's Azrael's reputation that concerns me. Aligning ourselves with him might become necessary.
Clark wasn't sure what this was all about, but wanted to help.
Is there anything I can do?
Bruce tilted his head toward Clark.
I doubt it, but thanks for the offer.
Well then, how about some cookies?
The treat was graciously accepted. Even Jason reluctantly took one. He broke off pieces, one bit at a time, inspecting each crumbling morsel before eating them. After the others ascended the stairs into Wayne Manor, Clark and Bruce spoke on their own. Bruce explained Jason's unexpected return.
It's only been a few days, and I still have my doubts he can adapt, but we'll see.
It's good to see him again. At least, once I got over the initial shock. I'm sure he'll be all right.
Bruce gazed into the darkness of the cave.
I hope so. But what brings you here at this hour? I'm sure the cookies could have waited.
Oh no, they couldn't. I wanted to get them to you warm. But really, it's this Morrow situation.
Once updated, Bruce offered his perspective.
I haven't found anything on him either, but if you must pursue it, your solution's obvious. You need to talk to those scientists again.
Clark shook his head.
It's no use. I don't see what difference it'll make.
Bruce's wry smirk crept onto the corner of his mouth once more.
I'm not suggesting you talk to them as Clark Kent. Perhaps you've forgotten how persuasive Superman can be.
Bruce gave him a wink, and Clark was set at ease. He was out of practice in these matters, and appreciated the reminder. His next few days were busy with the kids' extracurricular activities, yet Clark set time aside the following week to return to Magnus Labs and ask some questions of Superman. Will Magnus was caught off guard by his visit.
He welcomed Superman inside, yet seemed concerned as he did so, looking both ways out of the front door of the lab. His android, Auriferous, sat in the corner, working on basic motor tasks. Magnus's colleague, Niles Calder, was not present. Neither was a good deal of the equipment that once filled the lab. Once inside, Magnus's demeanor relaxed some.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Superman. I'm a big fan of your work. I realize Auriferous there doesn't look too impressive at the moment, but you were my original inspiration when I set out to build him."
Thanks, Dr. Magnus. I'm flattered."
"Please, call me Doc. But what can I do for you? This is certainly an auspicious visit."
"Well, Doc, I came to meet you and your associate, Niles Calder."
Magnus's ease dropped away, and the smile fell from his face.
"Eesh, I'm sorry to say. Niles and I, we had a falling out. Auriferous over there had an utter system failure, and well, Niles and I disagreed on the best path for recovery. But all in the past. Is there anything I can do for you, Superman?"
"Actually, yeah, Doc. I need to ask you some questions, and I need you to be honest with me."
Magnus's weight shifted under his feet, back and forth as he stood in place.
"What's, the matter, Superman?"
"I need you to tell me what Thomas Morrow spoke to you about at the robotics seminar in Central City 4 years ago."
Magnus came to a still. His eyes widened and his mouth hung agape.
"How could you know about that? Did Niles talk to you, or was it Morrow?"
"Neither. I just want to know what Morrow is up to and what he has to do with your work."
"Look, it's no secret I used to work under Morrow, before he started going by that silly name. And I got where I am thanks to him, and for that I'm grateful. But it's just a step too far to give him any credit for designing Auriferous. We were just days away from solving our equation when Morrow catches us in the elevator and shows us the solution. It makes no sense that he even knew the equation we were trying to solve, let alone the answer. So he may want to take credit for the patent, but he had nothing to do with it, I swear."
As Doc Magnus's story unwound, Clark's left eyebrow slowly raised. What was he hearing? Was this a patent dispute? Leaving Magnus Labs, Clark had a new angle. He wondered if perhaps all of the scientists on his list were in a similar conflict with Morrow. The next afternoon, Clark proceeded to Gotham University to confront Carter Nichols and Percival Sutter. Sutter, the younger of the two men, was by himself when Superman walked in. He stood still, like a deer in headlights. The laboratory was even more stripped bare than Magnus Labs had been. Sutter appeared to have recently been packing. His eyes scattered around the room, returning to the caped hero.
"You must be looking for Professor Nichols, of course. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, he resigned after that embarrassing incident yesterday."
"I'm sorry, that's not why I'm here. I need you to tell me what your business is with Thomas Morrow."
Sutter's brow grew severe, his face turning red.
"Whatever Morrow told you was an outright lie. The man is a snake. He stole our research and wants to sell it back to us."
"Whatever is going on, I want to help."
Sutter quieted himself, taking a breath.
"Perhaps you can, Superman. I want to show you something."
Sutter walked toward a large piece of equipment in the lab. It appeared to be some sort of heavy medical device on a large hydraulic arm. Sutter pressed a button, and in a blink, he disappeared. In the same instant, the lights in the room turned on, the sky went from day to night, and a janitor stood in the corner, holding a plug to the device Sutter had just been using. The janitor dropped the plug.
"Are you all right there, Superman?"
Clark tried to orient himself.
Yeah, thanks. I think so. What happened to Sutter?"
"Professor Sutter won't be coming back, I imagine. Not after the way he quit today. I'd say more than one bridge got burnt."
Impressed by his own commentary, the janitor proceeded to crack himself up. As Clark let himself out, he wondered how long he had been there. Looking at his watch, it appeared to have only been a few minutes, yet the sun had long set. Whatever that device was that Sutter had used on him, it hadn't just stopped his perception of time. Back at home, it was nearly midnight when Clark found Lana waiting for him. She had been researching and had news to share. In the past 4 years, Morrow had filed hundreds of patents and was embroiled in dozens of legal battles involving them. Looking over the many cases, Clark felt a relief that even if this wasn't a crime, it wasn't so bad. Yet he also couldn't help but feel frustrated.
"This certainly isn't a matter for Superman."
"No, it's not," but Victor Sage never came looking for Superman's help.
Clark couldn't argue, and though he had no intention of writing a book about the white-collared crimes of Tio Morrow, he kept tabs on the Futurist and all of his legal cases. It was a slow and boring hobby, but Clark's family life more than made up for it. Shortly after the twins' 12th birthday, Linda took up ballet classes. It was a tiny dance studio with only a few other students, but she took the practice with all seriousness. Clark's afternoons and weekends became filled with chauffeuring his children to and fro for their many events. The autumn, each year, was filled with music recitals, dance recitals, soccer matches, and organizing the harvest ball. Jerome once again had a lead role in the school play. All the family but little Linda lent in to help him learn to read his lines. Joseph was especially critical.
"You have to be really, really loud at that part." "Which part?" "The part where you got quiet. That should have been the loud part."
Linda made suggestions of her own.
"And you should do a spin when you come out."
Jerry argued against the spin, but tried it anyway. He ended up liking the flair it added and threw in a few more spins and fancy moves to give his character style. Despite the constant activities between family and tree planting duties, Clark's mind kept finding its way back to Tio Morrow. All of Morrow's activities had checked out as technically legal, but Clark got the feeling that regardless of legality, something felt morally wrong. Not long after the Harvest Ball, while watching Jerome's opening night performance, Clark was inspired to think about his problem differently. His interpretation of the play led him to speculate. He wondered if spending some time to occasionally work alongside the Justice League International and learning a bit about them might give him the insight he needed into Morrow's machinations. Clark ran the plan by Kara when she came to visit Kent Farm for some home-cooked dinner.
"So, don't get mad, but I figure the best way to see what they're up to is to volunteer."
Kara's brow turned down and her jaw hung slack.
"Oh, really now? You expect me to volunteer?"
"No, not you. Me."
"Oh, no, no, Clark. You can't do this to us. You've been retired for way too long, and we're straining for a lack of new members right now. You have got to volunteer for the Justice League before you do anything with Maxwell Lord and his clown show."
"Well, okay. But after that, I'm going to start working with the JLI, at least once a month."
"On second thought, you can't do that either."
"What? Why not?"
"It will make it seem like you came out of retirement, but we weren't good enough. I'm going to need you to keep volunteering with the Justice League at least twice as much as you do with the JLI."
"Twice as much? Is that necessary?"
Yeah, duh. This is an image war, and we are losing."
"It's not a war. It's more of a popularity contest, and you have nothing to worry about. People love Supergirl. And who doesn't love an underdog story?"
Kara rolled her eyes and looked at Clark, emphasizing her lack of amusement.
"You should have quit while you were ahead."
He didn't know what he had said to invoke such a reaction, but took the hint and made no more attempts at cheering her up. While making motions to step back into the public eye as Superman, Clark had misgivings simmering in the back of his mind. His retirement from the stage of superheroes had been for a good reason. In light of Lex Luthor's particular psychosis, centered around the last Kryptonian, Clark considered Superman's inclusion in the Justice League, or the JLI, to be a delicate matter. That Christmas, the Kents delighted in the company of Bruce and Damian Wayne, along with Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon. Damian had recently had a growth spurt and was a lanky teenager. With his new size came a new self-consciousness and an uncommon aloofness towards his old friends, Joseph and Jerome. After dinner on the second night, Damian tried to excuse himself for the evening.
"I'm going to our accommodations. Thank you for the fine dinner."
Linda objected outright.
"You can't. We have to watch a movie tonight."
"You can tell me about it tomorrow."
"But we're making hot cider. You have to stay, Damian."
In the face of Linda's persistence, Damian eventually gave in. While the kids watched a holiday movie, Clark and Bruce sat in the kitchen drinking their cider. Bruce came up with a suggestion for Clark's Superman dilemma.
"How about a mentorship program? Superman doesn't have to come out of retirement, but maybe he can come back as a proponent of truth and justice. Act as a kind of figurehead."
"Like a mascot?"
"No, but, well, basically, yes. But through some kind of official mentorship program."
"So more PR then, instead of actually helping people."
"If the question is how to do this without stirring Luther's ire, then the solution will be a matter of public perception." only in this case, it's specifically Luther's perception we're catering to. Put that way, Clark conceded to Bruce organizing a mentorship program under a shell company. Barbara overheard the conversation and had some input of her own.
If we pitch this as a means to keep Superman in retirement, I imagine we could probably even secure some funding for this mentorship program from LexCorp.
Bruce looked at Barbara. Are you volunteering? She laughed at his question.
If we're getting LexCorp money, this better be a paid position.
Being the daughter of Gotham's former police commissioner, Barbara had many of the requirements needed to organize a non-profit superhero mentorship program. By early spring, when they got the ball rolling, she included a handful of the Justice League's other retired members. The original Green Arrow and Black Canary joined as mentors, along with Jefferson Pierce, formerly Black Lightning, and Black Canary's mentor, Wildcat. Also, Michael Holt, better known as Mr. Terrific, volunteered to join the program, despite not officially being retired. Clark left the organizing to Barbara, but he couldn't help from questioning their strategy when they met for their first scheduling meeting.
Are you sure we shouldn't be reaching out to the Justice League International directly?
Yeah, we're definitely not doing that. We want them to come to us. Don't you worry, big guy. They'll want a piece of this. Trust me.
To Clark's surprise, this new program, the Justice Society of America, started reaching out to schools, libraries, and retirement homes across the country. As Barbara explained it, their outreach would be most effective and least intrusive to Luther in these quaint settings. From the outset of the Justice Society of America, Clark led his fellow mentors in on the purpose of forming their organization. This message was lost on their eldest member, Ted Grant, the hero once known as Wildcat. He was in his early 70s and saw this as his last hurrah, having been a hero back when being a vigilante for justice was something barely heard of, and not the glorified public figures they had become. Ted saw the shabby conditions on the schools, libraries, and old folks' homes they visited, and had no personal filter to stop him from speaking his mind. Being at these public outreach events with Ted came with an endless litany of complaints.
Low ceilings again. It's always with the low ceilings. Can you believe this carpet? Disgusting. If I had to live my last days on linoleum all day, every single day, I would hope for less days, if you know what I mean. Here we go again, being paraded around like circus animals in front of screaming children. This is embarrassing. What a way to retire.
Statements like these, referring to his sense of disgrace, were invariably followed by a mention of Superman.
My only consolation is sharing my fate with this guy. If even Superman ended up in this pit, it can't be all bad.
Ted Grant's sentiment of shame for being relegated to small shambled venues was short-lived, as the JSA began appearing on university campuses and on occasion with the actual Justice League. He felt appreciated at these celebratory events, though still lacked any sense of filter.
Now we're talking. Not like that dump of a library back in Nowhereville, am I right?
Sure enough, as Barbara had promised, it wasn't long before Maxwell Lord reached out to the Justice Society of America and attempted to broker a partnership. Lord showed more gumption than Clark had ever imagined, offering the JSA mentors to escort the Justice League International on their patrols. Barbara made the scheduling look arbitrary, but managed to book Clark time with all of the JLI members separately. Meanwhile, the other Justice Society mentors were in on Clark's investigation, ready to report back anything they learned about Thomas Morrow. As expected, Maxwell Lord publicized that the JLI was working with the Justice Society mentors. The moment Barbara secured the dates, Lord was announcing their affiliation and making the rounds on news networks worldwide. The morning that Superman was expected to make his first appearance with the JLI, Clark caught a glimpse of a new Maxwell Lord interview.
That's right. This is the beginning of a new era. The JLI has been made of the best of the best, but with the Justice Society's guidance, we're taking justice to a whole new level.
Clark sighed, and Lana caught it.
What's going on, Clark? Are his empty platitudes getting you down?
Clark chuckled. Her description wasn't far off.
Mostly, yeah, but I knew this was coming from the get-go. I just hope Barbara can keep this from turning into exactly what Kara asked me to avoid.
Clark, from experience, let me tell you. My first marriage wasn't pretty, but I learned a few things. When you're dealing with someone trying to control the narrative, you can still keep some of that control by setting their expectations pretty low.
I eventually got out of my marriage by not showing up altogether.
This line of thinking puzzled Clark. He leaned back in his seat and looked toward his wife.
So, what are you suggesting exactly?
I'm thinking maybe you can cancel your first few patrols with them at the last moment. Maybe send a substitute in your place. Let Max Lord burn out on whatever expectations he has. Then, only show up sporadically.
You had to do that with Ted?
No, but I wish I had. He was a nightmare and I just went along with it.
Barbara laughed when Clark suggested they use the strategy with the JLI.
You want to play hard to get? Not a bad idea. Michael is already asking for more shifts. If we can get him in their ready room, we can learn a lot about that fancy global matrix monitor they keep bragging about. But how much better could it be than Bruce's computer, right?
As planned, Clark missed the first two patrols with the Justice League International and was fashionably late for the third. When Superman arrived, Ted Kord confirmed his timing was indeed perfect.
Oh man, you just missed Maxwell. He thought you weren't coming again.
Oh, too bad. Did I miss the camera crew too?
Yeah, he was super disappointed.
Well, maybe next time. But I understand I'm riding with you and Booster in the Beetle Buggy today.
Oh yeah, for sure. Booster's on his way. He just has to find Skates first.
While they waited, Ted showed Clark his newest additions to the Beetle Buggy. Booster Gold announced his approach with his loud voice as he lectured his hovering drone assistant, Skeets.
That's no excusio, Skeets. I need you, Terry, Stokely. You can't be researching every detail of the universe when we have a patrol with Super Duper Man.
Booster stopped, frozen, when he saw Superman had already arrived.
Brosies, I was just talking to Skeets about you.
Hey, Booster. Hey, Skeets.
Booster spoke in a hushed voice to Skeets.
Skeets, that's not funny.
What did he say?
Oh, he was just saying something about the probabilio that you'd be a no-show today.
Clark was happy to see Kara's plan was working as expected. Even Skeets didn't see it coming. The next few hours were spent listening to Blue Beetle explain his theories on various alien technologies he imagined. While they flew over Europe, T.O. Morrow proceeded to periodically call in, directing them on a seemingly arbitrary course. Clark's mind was going a bit numb listening to Ted speculate when they got a message from Morrow for their ship to descend. Hearing this news, Booster gently rubbed his hands together in anticipation.
Here we go, brosies. Now it gets really-o.
Their craft came to a hover around downtown Berlin. Booster and Ted stood up from their ship's console and began their own stretching routine. Clark looked out the window and saw nothing of note or particularly suspicious.
What happens next? Do we just wait here?
With his feet spread apart, Ted broke it down, leaning side to side, stretching his lats.
Tio usually gets us to the scene of the crime a little early. It's pretty neat. We have a few minutes to get ready before the action starts.
Booster concurred, and proved to be exceptionally flexible, standing folded in half with his head between his legs.
For realio, duders, you should stretch it out, Superman. You'll thank yourself for it later.
Clark, not expecting to exert himself, didn't bother to heed this advice. Instead, he returned to peering out the window.
How exactly does Morrow know where to send us?
Ted began stretching his hips with a lunge pose.
He's hooked up his brain into the Matrix monitor, so he totally sees what's coming. It's super neat.
Performing slow neck rolls, Booster elaborated.
For realio, and it all goes through Skeets here, so Skeets is able to verify what Tio sees and compare it to his crime database from the future.
Skeets has a database of future crimes?
They're past crimes for Skeets, but yeah, they're in the future for us.
Ted stood on one leg, the other outstretched in front of him, perfectly straight.
Super neat.
Clark scratched his chin.
So why doesn't Morrow just tell us what's happening and send us straight there?
Booster sunk into an impressive full split.
That would be a violation of the temporal codes, brosie. No candulio.
Their conversation concluded when Thomas Morrow notified them of a high-speed chase headed in their direction. Ted took to the helm, and the Beetle Buggy descended into the street below. They came to a hover just above the traffic on the road, and waited at the red light with the other vehicles.
Clark could hear sirens approaching. His instincts told him he should get out of their craft and meet the chase head-on, but he reminded himself of his role. As a mentor, he was there to observe and coach. No sooner than the traffic light turned green, a gaudy painted van blasted past the intersection in front of him. Multicolored smoke billowed out of the back of the van, followed by the local police, driving far enough behind to avoid being consumed by the smoke. Ted turned right to follow the chase.
Oh great, it's the Madman again. They are super not cool.
Clark hadn't heard of this group before.
Madmen? Yeah, they're a bunch of brainwashed mercenaries. They suck.
The beetle buggy caught up to speed in seconds, passing over the pursuing police and entering the plume of smoke. From there, Ted used his spatial sensory system to lock onto the van and maintain their distance inside the provided smoke screen. Clark wondered just what these two were planning.
Do you just grab them with your beetle beam? I wish. The madmen have a deflector for the beetle beam. That's a part of why they suck so much.
While Ted filled Clark in, Booster readied himself, opening the side hatch.
Here we go, brosies! Now we see the best part. Are you ready, O-Skates? Skates, get it together already, O!
Booster activated a knob on his belt and another on his ring, and with his drone companion at his side, he lightly stepped out of the door, racing forward with his arm outstretched in front of him. Clark again wondered how best he might help.
Should I maybe follow him?
Ted shrugged, staying focused on the monitor.
Whatever you want to do.
Clark hopped out of the open door and watched Booster with his own super senses. The hero from the future stayed inside the smoke screen until the last second when he smashed through the smoke-emitting machine and into the van. The smoke dispersed, and Clark watched through the van to see Booster as he stunned several fervent soldiers with energy bursts from his gauntlets. The van began swerving, and just when Clark thought he was going to have to step in, a net made of teal blue light sprung from the beetle buggy, ensnaring the van just as it lost control. Clark flew back into the side hatch of the beetle buggy to congratulate Blue Beetle.
Well done, Ted. Nice catch.
They descended slowly, setting the van down and releasing the net as the police and a small press pool arrived. Ted and Booster were eager to pose for pictures and talk to the press. They showed clear experience with the side of their job and demanded Superman join them. It was hard for Clark to say no to their genuine enthusiasm. Throughout the unfolding photo shoot, Clark couldn't stop himself from grinning and even chuckling as Ted and Booster went through a series of the most absurd poses, flexing their muscles. For having spent only a single night with the JLI, Clark was pleased with himself for how much he managed to garner in learning about their process and the role Morrow played in it. There was no time to share any of it as the Kent family was busy preparing for their summer camping trip. Only when they returned to their usual campsite in the north for a couple of weeks was Clark able to mull over all he had learned with the rest of the family as they sat around the morning campfire.
It's like he can see into the future. Morrow knows where and when a crime will happen, but not that far in advance. At least, according to some temporal code, if that's even a thing.
Okay, so Booster Gold mentioned a crime database from the future. I imagine that little Skeets fellow knows a lot more about the future than that.
Pete chuckled.
He would be the one to ask about lottery numbers.
Clark shook his head.
But how do we prove it? And if we could, would he see it coming?
The adults' conversation was drawn to a close when the children demanded someone join them at the river. The kids had become capable swimmers, even Linda, but knew they were expected to have supervision. Jerry said it bluntly.
It doesn't matter which one of you comes, but somebody better come.
Drew laughed.
That's not true. You're a stronger swimmer than me. I would just be a liability.
Linda urged Drew nonetheless.
That's okay. I can help you learn to swim better.
Drew slowly got up.
I guess I'm not getting out of this one. I'll head down to the river now, but somebody has to bring the leftover bacon down with lunch.
Clark was proud to watch his kids move through the water with ease. Returning to this place had become a kind of landmark for the family, demonstrating their growth over the previous visit. Each day, the family dog, Crypto, joined them at their campsite, looking to be fed and receive a little affection. He had grown a special bond with Joseph and Jerome, indulging in their company in their laziest moments, laying on the riverbank or at the campfire. Yet even while camping, Crypto came and went, managing his own time as a guard dog for the world's forests. That year, the trip concluded with a kind of blemish on their happy memories when Joseph and Jerome took their water fight too far. With their tempers inflamed, they never heard their sister's pleas before she was accidentally caught in the fray. It was more of an emotional injury than a physical one, but it brought on a cloud of gloom that still hung over the children for most of the remaining summer break. A couple of months passed without Superman returning to mentor for the JLI. Clark let several appointments lapse in that time and even attended Justice Society events with Kara, Wally, and John Henry from the actual Justice League. Clark was happy to have an excuse to see Wally. He took the blame for their distance on himself.
I'm really sorry I haven't been in touch.
Seriously, Supes, it's not you, it's me. I am lousy at time management. And trust me, being the fastest man on Earth will keep you surprisingly busy.
Kara repeatedly thanked Clark, especially after every photo op.
You have no idea how much this helps.
I'm glad to even the playing field, though heads up. I understand Maxwell's determined to work with me next, so expect to see him make a big deal of it.
As Clark promised, during his next appointment with the International Superheroes, Maxwell Lord greeted him on the landing pad at JLI headquarters.
Kal-El, always good to see you, sir. And an honor to work at your side.
Clark shook his hand and was set at ease by Lord's smile and warm embrace. Maxwell was almost too friendly. Clark tried to reciprocate the best he could under the circumstances.
Thanks, Maxwell. Though as a mentor, I'm only here to observe and do some coaching.
Maxwell laughed.
Well, as a manager, that's most of what I do.
He laughed again before continuing.
No, but seriously, Kal-El, I think there's a lot I can learn from you, so I deeply appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, well, glad to help. The pleasure's ours. Come on in. Can I get you something to drink? Maybe a slice of our famous apple pie?
Clark felt himself blushing, just a bit embarrassed to have spoken so well of such mediocre pie. Upon entering the headquarters, Clark was relieved of having to decline a slice. Thomas Morrow spoke to Lord the moment the blast doors closed behind them.
Maxwell, we have an incident occurring with 62% likelihood.
Thank you, Thomas. Please keep me posted on that. I'm going to take my mentor here for a slice of his favorite apple pie.
No, Maxwell, I think not. I've already sent the others to prepare the Justice Cruiser.
Maxwell paused, his brow raised.
Really? With a 62% incursion? Are you sure it's necessary?
Morrow, wearing his usual headset, turned away from them.
It's already up to 68%. I suggest you stop dallying. The others are waiting.
Of course, Thomas. We're on our way. There'll be time for pie later. I'm sure Kal-El won't mind.
Clark noted Morrow's curt treatment, but Lord shrugged it off.
Follow me, Kal-El. Let me show you our inertial lift. This thing is amazing.
Inside the elevator, Maxwell explained its inertial dampeners and how they allowed the carriage to descend the building in seconds with only a single G-force felt. Clark suspected this was an exaggeration as he sensed their descent, but it was still quite impressive. The lift went underground and proceeded to carry them horizontally under the city with incredible speed. It let them out in an underground hangar bay. Most of the JLI had already taken their seats. The Green Lantern, Guy Gardner, gave Clark a wink when he stepped aboard.
There he is. I knew my boy wouldn't let us down this time.
Clark greeted the team of familiar faces. Stargirl, Stripesy, Bloodsport, and Guy. Though once on board, Maxwell invited Superman to sit with him in the cockpit. Clark noted the Justice Cruiser's separate flight cabin was very different from the Javelin 17, where the Justice League all sat together inside the jet. Lord offered little conversation along the flight as he occasionally took direction from Morrow. Clark asked questions along the way.
Do we even know where we're headed?
Not yet. Thomas prefers we be up in the air as he determines our destination. I maintain a holding pattern until he says go.
That's an awful lot of trust you have in him.
Yes, it's true. He's very good at what he does.
You've known him a long time then?
Well, of course. Since the beginning of the Justice League International. He was the third member right after Stripesy and Stargirl. I don't know how we could have gotten this far without him. The man's a bit of a genius.
Their chit-chat was interrupted by Morrow, sending them on a course towards South Africa. Clark's curiosity kept him on edge.
What's happening in South Africa?
Oh, probably nothing. Or maybe something. Or definitely something.
It's hard to say just yet, but Thomas has to get us moving in some direction just to be sure.
Only minutes later, new orders were received, turning them toward Turkey. After that, Each message from Morrow directed them more precisely to their hypothetical target. Approaching a coastal city on the Mediterranean Sea, Maxwell Lord engaged the autopilot to hold a flight pattern while he headed back to talk to the others.
All right, team. Thomas has confirmed the incursion is at 93% and rising. We're currently above Alcipe, a popular casino villa on the Aegean coast. Gardner, take Dubois down to the surface. Stargo, Stripesy, you two stay in the air, just offshore, about 500 meters. Let's go, people. We've got a world to save.
The four of them rose from their seats and headed toward the back of the jet. As they reached the cabin door, Lord gave them one more word of encouragement.
And remember, everyone, you're the best. You've got this.
Stargirl turned back to give Maxwell a little salute and wink as she followed the others out the door.
You know it, boss.
Lord turned to Superman.
How about it, Kal-El? How would you like to see my command station?
Sure, of course.
Maxwell pressed a button, revealing a staircase leading into the belly of the plane. Down below, the walls and floors were made of monitors, displaying a composited image made from the jet's outer cameras. In the center of the room was a large affixed seat with a sleek control panel. Lord sat down and looked back at Superman.
Beautiful, right?
Clark nodded. Scanning over it all once more, he had to admit this was truly a work of fine craftsmanship, executing deft design choices.
You've outdone yourself, Maxwell. This is incredible. I appreciate the compliment, but it won't mean much if we don't do this.
Lord leaned forward, pressing a button on his console.
Thomas, what's our incursion percentile?
I thought you would never ask, Maxwell. We're at 94% and slowly rising.
Fantastic. Contact me at 97. Over and out.
Ciao, Maxwell.
Lord cut the channel and checked in with the others. Everyone was ready. When all stayed silent for a few minutes, Clark had to ask.
What happens next?
It's a waiting game. As long as the incursion percentile is still increasing, we're going in the right direction. Currently, holding here is enough. We don't want to get too close or we risk collapsing the incursion altogether.
Wouldn't that just mean preventing a crime from ever happening to begin with?
You would think, but then no one would know if it was working or not. In fact, we wouldn't even know. We can't prevent bad things from happening, but we can minimize damage and get a little credit along the way.
Put that way, this strategy made more sense to Clark. Yet he was curious how much Lord knew about Morrow's other dealings.
I hope you don't mind me asking, Maxwell, but how well do you know Thomas Morrow?
Thomas?
I trust him with my life. Why are you asking? Well, let's just say he has a mixed reputation in several scientific communities. As it is patent lawsuits, it's a shame that a mind like his gets embroiled in petty lawsuits. He could be moving on to create greater innovations, and he does, but the poor man wastes his energy with that nonsense. So, you know about them?
Oh yes, I most certainly do.
And you don't think he's up to something?
Up to something? The man is a veritable genius. And technology is moving so fast these days that scientists are bound to make the same breakthroughs only days apart from each other.
It's hard to argue with that. It's an unfortunate situation, but I trust Thomas, and I hope you can too. I can't tell you how much it means to me that you're here with us today. I hope you can come to trust this family of mine. We aren't the same Justice League you created, but we're trying our damned hardest to make you proud.
Clark felt a bit embarrassed to have pressed this topic so outright. He wondered how he had let a raving conspiracy net send him to such extremes of spying on a likely innocent man. While Clark became lost in reflection, the JLI took action. A massive yacht had lost control and was barreling toward the shore. In a few short moments, Maxwell's team pivoted, halting the ship and seeing to the captain's emergency medical needs. The boat was occupied by a gathering of incredibly wealthy partygoers. Maxwell was delighted by this news.
This is an investor opportunity for the JLI like we could have never dreamed. Let's land the cruiser and join the party. What do you say, Kal-El? Care to join me?
Clark fought the strangest curiosity to attend, yet felt nauseous at the thought. Instead, he excused himself early. As he flew over the Mediterranean Sea, Clark's watch rang. For the first time in a long while, Booster Gold was calling.
Superman, Deuters, we need your help immedio. Skates is on the fritz.
I don't know if I'm the one to call about this.
No, Superman.
Something is up, but it's like a conspirio.
Where are you, Booster?
We're in Sicily. You just flew over us.
Clark turned back to find Ted and Booster on the small Italian island. Skeets was flying himself, repeatedly banging into the inner shell of the beetle buggy, changing directions with each collision and repeating the process. Clark felt bad for the little drone.
What's wrong with Skeets?
Tutors, everything!
Ted explained Booster's despair.
We went into his system to give him a tune-up, and we found Tio was in there accessing his files on weapons of mass destruction. And his digital footprints were everywhere. He's really messed Skeets up.
Hearing this news, Clark struggled to swallow.
You found him? In Skeets.
Booster recovered from his dismay for a moment.
Tutors, Tio Morrow has been stealing from the future.
Ted rested a hand on his friend's shoulder.
And we're gonna stop him, Stokely.
Booster looked up. The distress in his eyes lingered, but eased.
Stokely.
Clark needed them to organize quickly. They had to gather proof that Morrow was on the inside of Skeet's databases. Clark didn't know what temporal codes Morrow was violating, but this was a start. Well past midnight, as they parked on the Mediterranean Sea, Ted and Booster were feeling confident that they had nearly all the evidence they needed when Morrow disappeared from Skeet's system. On the flight back to their base, they received a call from headquarters, but it wasn't Morrow. It was Guy Gardner.
Hey, Clown Patrol. You two better head back. We had ourselves a little shakeup over here, but you two can check it out on the news. Max is doing a press conference right now. Anyway, over and out, dummies.
They immediately went looking for Maxwell Lord's debriefing. When they found the live broadcast, he was already concluding. But the chyron at the bottom of the screen said it all. The Justice League International had arrested Tio Morrow for embezzlement. Maxwell Lord's brow furrowed with grief.
This is a tragedy and a disappointment. But a good friend of mine helped open my eyes. And moving forward, I believe the Justice League International will be better than ever.
Clark sincerely doubted this would go well for them. Morrow was an asset to the JLI, enabling their more than punctual response times. Making matters worse, they no longer had Skeets in operation. Clark felt bad for Maxwell Lord, though it certainly felt nice to hear Maxwell refer to him as a good friend. After a long night in Europe, Clark managed to return home for dinner. When he arrived, Jerry was on his own, kicking a soccer ball around in the field adjacent to the Langs. Inside the Kent home, Joey was practicing his violin while Linda played nearby. Lana and Martha were just beginning to set the table when Clark walked in. The kitchen appeared unusually overrun. The counters were loaded with food, and every mixing bowl seemed to have been used and piled in the sink. Clark had never seen the kitchen in such a state.
What's the occasion? Are we having a party?
Martha began transferring the food to the table.
Not officially a party, but Drew landed a big carpentry contract, and I thought we ought to celebrate. Clark, would you be a sweetheart and take care of that sink full of dishes for us?
Sure thing, consider it done.
This was no exaggeration. Within a minute, every mixing bowl was precariously stacked in the drying rack. Lana called Linda and Joey to dinner, just as Pete and Drew walked in the door, along with Hank and Sarah Lang.
Perfect timing, you four. We were just about to sit down.
Pete smiled, taking in a deep breath through his nose.
It smells amazing.
Drew's hands raised to his cheeks as he marveled at the table.
Martha, Lana, you shouldn't have.
Martha waved a dismissive hand.
Nonsense, Drew. You deserve a little celebration.
Clark patted Drew on the back.
Yeah, sounds like congratulations are in order.
As everyone began to sit, Lana pulled the main course from the oven where it was staying warm.
Clark, honey, can you call Jerry in? He's playing by my mom and dad's house.
Outside, standing on the back porch in the late summer evening, Clark could hear Jerry kicking his ball. He called out to his son that it was time for dinner, and Jerry replied with a loud yell.
Coming!
Clark smiled in satisfaction before returning inside. No sooner than he was back in the kitchen did Jerry follow him in. This gave Clark pause, noting how quickly Jerome made it inside. As everyone sat down at the table, Martha snapped Clark out of his contemplation.
Clark, the gravy boat's at the bottom of the dish rack, and you stacked those dishes too high for me to get at it. Can you help?
Clark emptied the drying rack and was returning the dishes to the cupboard when Martha accidentally bumped the gravy boat from the counter, sending it falling to the kitchen floor. In that instant, Clark's perception of time shifted. This was Martha's heirloom gravy boat that had belonged to her grandmother. Stacked in Clark's hands were Martha's favorite set of mixing bowls. He needed to make a decision. Could he move fast enough to save the gravy boat without risking the bowls? Before he could act, the decision was made for him. Joseph leapt from his seat at the table, and Clark watched in awe as his son fell to the ground and slid his hand under the gravy boat, not spilling a single drop of gravy. The family cheered, but it gave Clark pause. Even for him, watching in slow motion, Joseph had moved surprisingly fast. Thank you for listening. I'm Isaac Bluefoot. Book 2 of Son of El was written and independently produced by myself. And technically, we're only halfway through the book now. This is the final episode of Season 3, and I must admit there's likely going to be a longer stretch between this season and the next than there was between this season and the last. So I'll be at work on the next part for a little while. In the meantime, I hope you keep sharing the show, writing reviews, rating it, and most especially, I hope you consider becoming a patron. Go to sonofelpodcast.com/support. The little bit you give there, collectively, can keep pushing this project forward to my front burner, so to speak. I have a lot of projects in the fire, and somehow have to find a way to support myself during all of it. So I really appreciate the help. Thank you so much. If all goes according to plan, there'll be a third book after this one. So let's all hope I manage to pull that off. And thank you for all you do to help me get there. However you show your support. I really appreciate it. This story was inspired by the Superman and DC comics and characters originally created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, with additional contributions by Len Wayne, Kurt Swan, Gardner Fox, Carmine Infantino, John Byrne, Bernie Wrightson, Bill Finger, John Sakella, Bob Kane, Mike W. Barr, Grant Morrison, Andy Kubert, Kelly Puckett, Damian Scott, Jerry Conway, Don Newton, Dennis O'Neill, Joe Quesada, Neil Adams, Julius Schwartz, Ross Andrew, Robert Caniger, Arnold Drake, Bob Haney, Bruno Premiani, Steve Ditko, Jim Mooney, Otto Binder, Al Plastino, Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatisse, Kevin McGuire, Julius Schwartz, Mort Weisinger, George Papp, Dick Dillon, Bill Finger, Erwin Hansen, John Ostrander, Tom Mandrake, Sheldon Mayer, Gardner Fox, Steve Ditko, Gary Friedrich, Dan Jurgens, John Broom, Louis Simonson, John Bogdanov, Gil Kane, Hal Sherman, Jeff Johns, and Lee Motor. Music in this episode was made by Anatech, Axeltree, Mr. Smith, Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, Vortex, Fabian Measures, Sergey Quadrado, Mello C, Jazar, David Hillowitz, Kirk Osamayo, Little Glass Men, Ricky Eats Acid, Beauchamp, Beat Mechanic, Aldous Ignite, and The Insider. See the episode notes for details. And be sure to listen to the next episode, Chapter 20, Reaching New Heights.